Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
I know this sounds weird, but just follow along here for a moment. I want you to close your eyes and think of Conan O'Brien. In your mind, you're probably picturing a tall, lanky Irishman with carrot-colored, poofy hair, a pointed nose, and a big Cheshire Cat-like smile. I don't need to tell you what he looks like because Conan is one of the most famous talk show hosts in America. Now, there's a reason I note this about his fame, and it's one we're going to get to in today's podcast. But before we begin, let's keep playing. Keeping your eyes closed, imagine walking into a set of offices on a Los Angeles film lot, and everywhere you look, there are pictures of Conan. There are posters of him on the wall. As you walk down a hallway, there are photos of him stuck to cubicles. There's even a bobblehead of him on someone's desk. Well, welcome to Conan O'Brien's studio on the TBS lot, where I'm sitting right now. You can probably guess why I'm here, so without further ado, you're listening to Inside the Hive. I'm your host, Nick Bilton, and my guest today is none other than Conan O'Brien. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Well, I think this is your time to come clean. Do you regret voting for Donald Trump?
Look, I always back the winner. And I think I made the right call.
So you and I met in San Francisco at a dinner, right? Mm-hmm. And Donald Trump was not president yet. And we got into a conversation about we didn't actually think he was going to be president. Is that correct at the time?
No one did.
No one
actually.
Did.
If you look at the New York Times headlines in the months before Trump was elected, every headline is Trump win an impossibility.
Yeah, it was like 10% chance of him winning. So you and I got into this discussion about how it was bizarre that there was even a possibility that a celebrity, which is what he was, still is maybe, could be president. And you had this fascinating theory about celebrity that you wanted to write for the New England Journal of Medicine. Is that correct?
It's a theory I've been working on for a long time, which is this theory I have that fame alters biochemistry and probably biology to some degree, and that it's, in a sense, a very powerful drug, and that it should not be allowed, children should not be allowed to have fame. That it's like giving them a very powerful cocaine.
And so what are the repercussions of it? You mentioned Michael Jackson.
My theory is that when people are exposed to intense fame early on, every drug, every narcotic has its side effects. Alcohol is one of the best drugs in the world at taking away shame, apparently. Mm-hmm. It neutralizes the shame center of the brain almost immediately, which is why people act a certain way when they're drunk.
Dancing on tables.
Yeah, having children, investing in Florida real estate. And I had this theory that I thought of a while ago, which was that fame, well, it's not really a theory, but fame removes gravity. It takes the gravity out of
a person's
existence. And people would say, well, what do you mean exactly? And I like to use analogies. And I would say, I once saw footage, and this is something I kind of want to write up one day, but I once saw footage of Russian cosmonauts landing on the steppes, you know, the tundra in the Urals or something. Our astronauts land in the Pacific Ocean, which is the way it's supposed to be done, in a parachute, and they splash down and we fish them out of the sea.
But the Russians wanted to make it look good.
The Russians, well, they have no choice. They have to land on the steps. So what they did is they had them land and they would pull them out of their capsule. And the Russians, because they couldn't beat us getting to the moon, what they did is they had their cosmonauts stay in space for a really long period of time and say, we beat the Americans, our cosmonauts have been up there for 3 years, whatever. These cosmonauts would land, they'd take them out of the capsule, and they would lay them out on these reclining chairs and interview them, and they couldn't move. They were like jellyfish. Because
they've been up in space for so long.
They've been up in space for so long, and people wondered, what is that? Why do we become jellyfish if we're in space for so long? And they realized that you actually need gravity to stack the calcium appropriately in our bones. You actually need, and we know this now, but you need gravity and you need resistance to create strong bones. And without it, our bones turn to jelly. And that's when I had this realization for some reason, looking at those cosmonauts lying there like freaks, like jellyfish, that they were great metaphors for celebrity, that they had had all of their gravity removed. And that's basically what happens to people like, we'll just name most celebrities. There's no gravity in their life. They have nothing pushing back on them.
And so the repercussions are that they, what do they think that they are? Greater than they? What are the repercussions of that?
I think it's, you know, a million things. First of all, what's interesting is that I say it's a metaphor, but you look at so many celebrities and they do actually physically become kind of freakish.
It's true. That is
and
very
they,
true.
And they start altering their appearance and they start having surgeries and they start, you know, in Elvis's case, eating way too much and just gorging themselves on sugar and fat. And there's nothing pushing back on them. No one's saying no. They start taking pharmaceuticals. There's no one to stop them. And so what happens is they actually sometimes start to really resemble freaks.
The cosmonauts.
Know? Yeah. And
so has this happened to you?
Oh, God, no. I'm not famous enough. I have very wisely tempered my fame. Well, I did that intentionally. I could have been a much bigger star.
Well, you're pretty. I mean, there was a market research study that was done in, about celebrities, and I believe it was 74% of Americans recognize you.
Right.
I mean, that's pretty famous.
They
I mean,
recognize me, but of 74%, I looked into that study. 64% violently dislike me. Now that's gravity. I'm constantly having to run and dodge.
No, but okay, come on. Let's be realistic. You are a very well-known,
yes.
famous
individual.
So how have you, very good-looking.
Let's not get crazy. Thin-lipped, beady-eyed. But, okay,
I've interacted with a lot of people over the years, and I've never had a conversation about the detriments of celebrity with someone who is a celebrity. It's usually them bragging about how they're a celebrity. So what is different?
Well, I have a bunch of things going for me. I did not become recognized on the street until I was 30 years old.
And that was...
I had just turned 30. It was April of 1993. I had been named the late night host. I was a writer on The Simpsons, writer-producer.
What happened? Were you walking down the street and someone...
And I had just been announced the day before. Literally the day before, my picture was everywhere. And I remembered I was going to meet, I think, Robert Smigel down in, you know, my first head writer and a guy I've worked with many times, genius. I went to meet him in Santa Monica, and I got out of my, I don't know, my car, parked my car and got out, and I walked about three steps, and a guy stopped me and said, hey, you're that guy, that TV guy. And he recognized me.
And how did that feel?
At the moment, it felt kind of, it didn't feel bad. It doesn't feel bad at first. It actually feels kind of
good.
It can feel good. It can feel, and that in itself isn't the problem. The problem is, what if I had been 8 years old or 10 years old or 15 years old? What if I had not fully developed as a person?
Yeah.
I had a bunch of things going for me, which is I had just turned 30, so I had 30 years on the planet of
no one recognizing,
no one recognizing me. I also have really good parents who are strong Catholics, and so I was imbued with, like, think of rebar inside a concrete wall.
That's a good
metaphor. I just had, like, iron, steel rebar in me of how to behave, how to treat other people. And I do think, and I had, I knew who my friends were. And so I had a very strong sense of self. So all those things combined.
But so okay, so if you walk down, if you went to the grocery store, do you go grocery shopping? Or mm-hmm.
For the purposes of me looking like a regular Joe, yes, I go.
Okay, so you go.
No, I do go grocery shopping.
No, so, sure. But so I'm sure 500 people recognize you while you're grocery shopping.
Yes.
Does it bother you? Is it exciting? What are you?
It's no longer
is it just like, oh,
exciting
God.
Because I stick out, meaning I'm six four, and I've got a Belgian pastry for hair, and my wife has noticed this. I've put on hats and sunglasses, and people just, when I walk into a room, it's as if Big Bird from Sesame Street put on a baseball cap and some sunglasses and was walking down the street. You'd be like, hey, Big Bird,
yep.
What's with the sunglasses and hat? That's what happens to me. So,
but how does it make you feel? Is it?
It doesn't feel, you know, it feels, I think I'm built for it. I like people.
Yeah.
I like people. I enjoy them. I like to hear their stories. I like to, I think it's genetic. I had a grandfather like this who apparently would just talk to anybody and everybody. I'm very comfortable around people. I don't feel physically threatened by people.
Well, you're 6'4".
And so I just feel like I like.
Is there so you know, and I'm asking you this because of this theory you have on fame, but is there a moment, are there moments throughout the day where you think, I wish I could just go to the park and not have someone talk to me? Or
yeah, I would say mostly it's. You know, and I'm not complaining again. I'm a big believer in don't complain, meaning any celebrity.
Very Irish Catholic of you.
Yeah, but also it's realistic too. I can make it stop,
yep.
Meaning I can stop doing this. I can do something else. And we have a very short attention span culture. And I think I have a warm place in comedy nerds' hearts. But I think
a few months from now, you could be walking down the street and people would be like, what's that guy? I remember that guy looks familiar.
Let's take a little longer than a couple of months, but it is going to erode. I can make it go away or I can diminish it a lot. I happen to really like what I do. And the only thing that's changed is the selfie. The selfie has changed everything. And you ask any person who's known, and the first thing they'll talk to you about is the selfie.
Is how everyone comes up to you on the street and wants to take a selfie?
They want a selfie. And then what happens is there's a phenomenon where people see you taking a selfie and they may not even care about you that much, but they see other people getting something and it's human nature to say, hey, that guy's giving away free gum. I don't even love gum, but it's free and I'd like a stick. So what happens sometimes is there'll be a couple of people that are real genuinely excited, and then you can see people that are like, yeah, why not? But they don't know how to work their camera. They want to make sure they're not happy with the first
hair.
Click.
Yeah.
They want another one. And I am very patient and very accommodating. And then sometimes it just gets kind of crazy because people line up.
And then what do you do?
Mostly just take them. I take selfies until there's no one left. And I really do.
Wow.
The idea of someone walking, and this is a character flaw of mine. This is not a humble brag. This is actually a character flaw, is I worry too much about, you know, someone having, and I got this from my mom, but no one can think poorly of you. And my dial in that direction has been set too high, meaning if there's 300 people there taking selfies with 299, but not the 300th, I'm going to be thinking later on, is that 300th person think I'm a jerk? And so that's an unhealthy reason to do it.
So going back to this celebrity concept, so one of the things that we've seen happen, especially over the last decade, and you've lived through this, is that there was a time 30 years ago where people were famous to a certain amount of people. And now it seems that you are famous to everyone because of digital media, internet, social media, blah, 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 blah. You know, as you as you look at the that trend with, you know, people being able to broadcast themselves, and, and there's this you know, irresistible appetite by teenagers to want to be famous. I mean, there was a study that was done, I forget who did the study, but there was a study that was done over many decades. And, you know, in the 60s, they asked kids, what do you want to be? And, I want to be a doctor when I grow up. In the 70s, it was, I want to be a pilot.
Yeah.
Fast forward to today, I want to be famous.
Yeah.
What do you think it's doing to society?
Well, I don't know what it's doing to society. I never know what the overall effect is going to be, and I'm suspicious of people who say they know. I have noticed that over the years, more and more young people come up to me, and young people always come up and say, I'm going to be on your show someday. And I used to say, oh yeah, what is it you do? And they'd say, well, I'm working on my rap career, or I'm an actress, or I'm a writer. But more and more over time, they would just say that, I don't know, I'm just going to be famous. Meaning how they got there didn't matter.
What's your response?
I try and sleep with them if it's possible and if they're of age. No, I don't lecture them there on the spot about.
But what is that?
What it says to me is that I've noticed this all the time. You say more people are famous, and I say, yeah, more people are famous, but it means less. Meaning, there used to be a handful of famous people. Literally, Clark Gable and about seven other people were really famous in the 1930s. Clark Gable being the most famous, you know? But it really did feel that way. Like and people in the 1930s, I remember Albert Brooks was talking to me once about this, and he's, you know, he in his Albert Brooks way, he said, you know, in the 1930s, people said, Clark Gable is the face of the 20th century, the most famous man. And then by 1960, who's thinking about Clark Gable? You know, oh, he's in the Misfits, and then he had a heart attack. But he's, you know, people didn't realize, people were declaring that Rudy Vallee was going to be one of the most famous faces of the 20th century in the 1920s. And they were not realizing that we were going to start churning out many more famous people than we would know what to do with. If you walk through a supermarket line now, I don't know who anybody is. I look at magazine covers and they're all reality stars. And it's Joanne and Chad, you know, talk about their recent breakup, or the stars of Flip Flop are at it again. And I don't know what they're talking about. And I'm not, you know, I watch television. I'm trying to partake in the culture, but I don't know those shows.
Yeah.
And there's more famous people than ever before.
But famous for being famous.
Famous for being famous, you don't even know what it is they do. And it would be hard to say later on, your work, Khloe Kardashian, has really fallen off. I liked your early work better. I mean, who would say that, you know?
So you have two kids, right?
Yeah.
And how old are they now?
They're 13 and 11.
Do you let them use social media? Are they allowed to broadcast themselves? And
No. We don't. I mean, we have a daughter who's allowed to, like, within a... She's allowed to post. She's an artist. She likes to. She's very good at drawing, painting, and she's allowed to show what she's working on to her friends on, you know, Instagram. But she's not allowed to broadcast it to the world. And, you know, my theory and my wife's theory is kids should be kids for as long as possible.
And does it worry you when you see this trend happening? And
or I think what worries me is which would worry any parent is. When you have kids, it's so funny, but the idea of their feelings being hurt is 1,000 times more painful to you than the notion that your own feelings would be hurt. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, meaning completely.
I have a
2-year-old. And
yeah. So the idea that someone would bully your kid or say something mean to them or that they would read on a post something unflattering about them makes me want to throw up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so sensitive on their behalf that it would just kill me. So that's difficult because it's mean out there. It's the anonymity of the internet has made it incredibly mean. And I think
so part of the reason why your daughter's account is private for that reason, does it in the opposite respect, does it bother your children when people say mean things about you?
You know, they haven't, it's interesting, they haven't really experienced that. I mean, they
does it bother you
when people say mean things about me?
Yeah, or are you just like whatever?
No, that's interesting. I was talking to someone once and they said, "Boy, to do what you do, you know, you got to have talent and a really thick skin." And this person was assuming that I have a thick skin, and I have an extremely thin skin. I'm very thin-skinned. My body temperature changes if, you know, I read something about myself that's unflattering. It's no different. I didn't get a tougher skin.
And that you haven't developed over 30 years?
No, and so what I do is I don't read, fortunately, over the years, many more nice things have been said about me than mean things, but I'd made a conscious choice at a certain point to not read either one. I don't eat the sugar. And I don't eat the bitter stuff. I just decided
from a lot of people I've spoken. I mean, I work in journalism, of course. People can say nasty, mean things, and that's the thing. You know, that don't feed the trolls and don't feed the nice people.
I'm stunned by how many people, you know, Gary Shandling, before he passed away, obviously a few years before he passed away. I think I was interviewing him, and then afterwards he was telling me, you know, after the last interview I did with you, I went online to see what people thought, and some people thought it was really funny, but other people were saying these really mean things about my appearance, and it upset me. And I said, "Gary, why are you reading the internet? The last thing I would ever do in my life is go read the bathroom wall scribbling that is the internet." Because
have you ever though? Your YouTube videos, some of them will get tens of millions of views. Do you pay attention to those numbers? Do you pay attention to any of that?
The
stuff?
Numbers, what I am aware of is, meaning I'm not completely in a vacuum because I think that would be dangerous too. So I have a really good group of people around me that I've had for a long time. And I don't have yes men. I have a bunch of no men and women around me that constantly give me resistance. And, you know, I am aware when something I do is really successful and liked. If I did something that people hated or outraged people, I'd know within seconds because people would come into the room and go, "That thing you just tweeted out or that thing we did last night really upset people," and I'd be made aware of what the feelings were. But I don't go looking for it myself because I think it's just too easy to get lost. You can just get lost in the weeds.
Was there a definitive moment that happened to you where you read a review of something or an event that took
place?
That
was pretty early on when I realized that. And this is, early 90s, I realized that obviously replacing David Letterman, the whole situation that I walked into and chose to walk into, and knowing that I had a lot of growing to do and I had to do it on the air in front of people, and I was aware that there was going to be a lot of negativity, and I just decided then, we're talking 93, 94 at a certain point, I just decided.
Pre-Twitter.
Well, yeah, this is all, I decided I just want to focus on the work. And all I wanted, what helped me a lot, what's helped me a great deal is focusing on all I ever wanted out of this was a body of work. That was my focus, and it's still my focus. Add to that body of work.
I have friends that are critics for mm-hmm. New York Times and Washington Post and mm-hmm. so on, and you know, there's a purpose for what they do.
Right.
We may not like the things they do sometimes and the things
right.
they say, but it is to kind of to inform culture and so on and so forth. And you know, I write books and part of me wants to know what the critics think. Part of me doesn't, whether it's good or bad, but part of me wants to know so I can learn as an artist, if you will.
I don't know. I mean, it may work for different people. I know that in a very broad sense, it helps. You know, when I started traveling my show a couple of years ago and going to Cuba and recently went to Mexico, and there was a lot of, it was not lost on me that there was a lot of positive. We really like seeing Conan in this environment, and we like seeing him out of the studio, and I got a lot of positive affirmation for it. I didn't personally go and read all of it, but my staff was really happy, and they were, you know, they would quote to me things about how, oh, this one thing, the headline was this. And I'd say, oh, that's nice. So in a broad sense, but what I was going off of more is that it felt right to me. Meaning if the press had said, we don't like Conan going to North Korea, or we don't like Conan going to Cuba, I would have said, well, that's weird because it feels really good.
Well, and the response has been phenomenal.
Yeah, but I guess what I'm trying to say is that what I'm trying to say is that there's a point where I have a it's nice to know that when what feels right to me feels right to the press. But I did have the experience early on in the early in 93, 94 of people saying, we don't like what this guy is doing. And then a bunch of them changing their minds later on, and me thinking, well, what if I had listened to them? I
mean, let's just say for the people listening out there that one day want to grow up and be Conan, and not be Conan for being famous, but right. be Conan for the creative side of things. If you were starting out today in the age of social media, how would you approach it?
You know,
in that respect,
not that different. I would counsel people, and I really mean this, to develop a really develop your inner compass. Develop your inner compass. What do you want to do? How you want to do it? And don't be overly reliant on what someone on Twitter thinks you should be doing, because you will be lost. I mean, if William Faulkner had been reading Twitter, you know, when Sound and the Fury came out, and the first five comments were, I don't get this, who's who, and it seems to be way out of time, and why are the voices so different, and how come these sentences are so long, he might have stopped, right? I mean, it's absurd. All of the world's great work has been done, you know, in a vacuum by people that are toiling away somewhere, and they do something magnificent, and they are unaware. Van Gogh was completely ignored, and I'm not in any way comparing myself to what I do to those people, but I think the concept is the same. The concept is the same, which is you have to know what you want to do, and you have to do it, and. Yes, there's a difference between constructive criticism from people you trust and just randomly hearing the opinions of people you'll never meet.
Just last question on this topic before we move on. When you look at, like the YouTube videos that you do with Ice Cube and mm-hmm. in the car and so on, when they do very, very well, does that want you, push you to do more of that?
No, that's the problem with me in this age, is that I almost go the other way and think, well, we did that, so I can't do it again. And of course, that can be stupid because sometimes.
So why not say, okay, well, this is work? I mean, the insult comic dog.
Yeah.
Was an amazing, brilliant thing. And
but
you
the jokes would
to do
change
it.
Every time, and the situation would change every time. I remember it after we did the Ice Cube, Kevin Hart thing, people saying you should just, this was before, James Corden was doing the singing in the car, and people were saying to me, like, you should just drive around in a car and do more stuff in a car. And I'd be like, no, we did the car. We did one of those. And it's like, well, James, who I like a lot, and these are very talented guys, showed, like, there's just, people have different philosophies, and everyone has to approach it their own way. And sometimes get very stubborn about thinking, we did that. Most of the really successful bits that I did in the first incarnation of my show, the late night show, I could have taken to TBS. I just decided not to. I thought, well, I did those, and if I don't do Year 2000 staring contest, you know, if they made it, I mean, the list goes on. These bits that we did that were very successful for us, I said, let's just not do as many of those as possible because it will force us to reinvent this.
You're listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
This episode of Inside the Hive is brought to you by SeatGeek, an app I personally use, which is by far the easiest way to find tickets for sporting events, Broadway shows, music festivals, and concerts, all instantly on your smartphone. SeatGeek searches multiple ticketing sites to compare prices and find amazing deals. Then they help you find the best value for your money by grading every ticket to identify the best seats that fit your budget. Perhaps most importantly, every single purchase is fully guaranteed on SeatGeek, so you can shop for tickets knowing that they're not fakes. Best of all, listeners of Inside the Hive get $20 off their first SeatGeek purchase today. So just download the SeatGeek app and enter the promo code HIVE, that's H-I-V-E, and you'll get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase today. Once again, the SeatGeek app and the promo code is HIVE, H-I-V-E. So you've been doing this 30 years now.
Well, let's see. I've been in comedy 31 years. I've been doing this show 24.
Did you, you were in a writer's room before you were behind a desk in front of a camera.
Yeah.
Was your dream to do the former or the latter? What was?
The dream was always to be completely in show business as much as I could, meaning I always wanted to get closest to the white hot center. And I remembered when I started in show business, being on the periphery. I worked on a show called Not Necessarily the News, and I was in a room, just like the room we're in right now, that was very sterile and antiseptic, and my job was to sit there with some other writers and bang out sight gags. I never met the cast. I was never on set.
You never met the cast? Wow.
Well, we'd meet them once a year or something at a Christmas party, but it was very antiseptic, and I remember thinking at the time, this isn't what I want. If I'm going to be in show business, I want to really be in vaudeville. I really want to be in show business. And so I kept skirting around the periphery, and then Saturday Night Live, when I got the job there, I remembered thinking, I'm getting closer.
So when you got the job at Saturday Night Live, you go into the writer's room, are you thinking, I want to be out on the stage?
No, it was interesting. Yeah, I very much wanted to, I was interested in performing, but I was not jealous. I was very aware that what Dana Carvey does, and what John Lovitz does is different from what I do. I always knew that my way of being funny had to be connected to my personality. And so when I was at Saturday Night Live, one example was I was on the 8th floor doing Saturday Night Live, and down on the 6th floor in 6A, David Letterman was doing his show, and this is the 80s. And that was, I had the Letterman fever. I mean, like all of us, I really thought that he, you know, between sort of 1982 and the rest of the 80s, I think he kind of split the atom. And that was very exciting. And so I was working at Saturday Night Live and much closer to what I wanted to be doing because I was at Saturday Night Live, you're there one day and they put you in a room with Steve Martin and say, pitch your idea.
Wow.
And he's really there.
Wow.
And it's really Steve Martin. And he's listening to you. And
is it terrifying?
It's terrifying. But it's still terrifying. You're just having a dessert with him.
He almost ran me over once. So there's a whole separate story there.
Oh, okay. Well, you probably deserved it.
Yeah.
And at Saturday Night Live, you're running under the bleachers to fix the cue cards seconds before your sketch goes on and the band's playing and you're backstage. I was backstage holding a horse in a sketch with Tom Hanks.
A real horse?
Yeah, holding a real horse by the reins, and I'm waiting to do my line with Tom Hanks live in front of, you know, 10 million people, and Keith Richards comes up and starts talking to me because he's the musical guest and he thinks that I'm the guy that owns the horse. And he's telling me, horses are the ones that save civilization. And it's all so surreal. And I thought, damn, I'm almost at the very center. I'm kind of at the center, but still not quite. And then I got the chance to try the late night thing. And it was a, I'm not an insane person. I had a very healthy fear of how badly I could get hurt and how badly it could all go.
How badly you could get hurt in what respect? That your career would end?
Yes, that I could go and be the famous disaster who took over for Letterman with no experience and become a trivia question.
Okay, so your goal back then is to get to the White Hot Center. What happens when you get there? Are you satisfied? Do you want more?
Want it to last. You want it to last.
You want it to last.
My goal for the first couple of years on Late Night, really for the first 5 years, was I need to survive. I need to survive, and I need this show to work, because if it doesn't, I'm the guy that failed, you know? I so desperately want this thing to work that I would have, you know, I used to tell people, you could shoot me in the stomach with a .38 caliber revolver, and I will still, just as the music for my entrance is playing, and I will still go out and do this show. And I will keep doing this show, and I'll have surgeries in between shows, but I'm doing these shows, and they're going to get better and better, and it's going to work.
But there's some fuel that is driving you. That is literally to entertain, to...
I really had this religious... I said, you know, I grew up very Catholic, and I had a religious belief that was challenged constantly that I could do this and that I should be doing it. And I cannot tell you where that comes from. It was just this idea that I had as a kid. So, I had this, you know, a friend recently found and sent it to me. I went to summer camp up in New Hampshire, Craggan Mountain Farm, and I was in cabin one, and it was 1975, so I was 12 years old, and we all had to write a little scrapbook for our cabin, and some guy found it and sent my entry, and I just saw this a couple of weeks ago.
What was the entry?
My entry said, if I had to describe my cabin, I would say it's a lot like a late night talk show.
Wow. And how old were you then?
12.
12.
And I'm talking about how...
In the cabin at 12 years old, are you performing?
Yes. I was always performing.
Always performing.
Always performing for my friends.
And did you... did they get sick of it? Did you get sick of it? Was it just...
No.
They all loved it.
It was my... You know, on a Darwinian level, you know what your strength is. You're hyper aware as a child of what your strengths are and what your weaknesses are. And I was hyper aware, and you... I think every kid does this. Everyone does this. They run through their checklist. And some kids early on know, I am really good at sports. And then they're like, you know what I'm really good at is baseball. And they hone in on that. Other kids know, I am really good at science.
And how did you decipher what you were good at?
It was process of elimination. There was a lot that I wasn't good at. Not a good athlete. Girls were not looking my way. I really liked girls, but they weren't that interested in me. But then I knew early on that I could make people laugh, that I could do that. I believe everybody runs through their checklist, and I ran through mine, and there was a lot of things that I didn't have, but I intuitively knew how to kind of make my friends laugh.
And so so you've gone from 12 years old, the goal, the White Hot Center, you get through it, you're here today. What's next? Like, what's the goal 10 years from now?
You know, it gets trickier when you have kids, and you get older, and you start to, you know, in some ways, get a little more philosophical and see the broader picture of, you know,
absolutely,
my kids are more important to me,
yep,
than
no question
my late night television show. And my wife is more important to me than my late night television show. And then you start to think, does that mean that it's either or can you find a way to still make the comedy good, but have a great relationship with your family and find balance? And it's a constant struggle. But, you know, I talked to Stephen Colbert on the phone yesterday, and we mostly were talking about kids, you know, he had kids a lot younger than I did, and his kids are in college, but it wasn't either or. I used to really think it had to be either or. And I was single for a long time. I was not married. I married late, and I had kids late because I just thought
it was comedy or nothing.
Yes.
And now you're questioning if it's...
No, my goal now is to constantly find ways to take what it is I do and stretch it and maybe grow it. And for example, if 5 or 10 years from now, because TV is changing so rapidly, I might not have a late night TV show, but I might have something that you can get on the internet where I go to different countries and I'm sort of a comedic ambassador, and that might be really fascinating for me.
Yeah, it was interesting. I used to be at the New York Times, and when the whole Jay Leno stuff happened, I wrote a piece, which I'm sure you didn't read unless it's cut out on your refrigerator at home now, about how you shouldn't have gone to a network. You should go and start your own web series. Bill O'Reilly, the guy from Fox who was on To Catch a Predator, he's just announced that he's going to do his own web show. Do you regret coming? I mean, of course you don't regret coming to TBS, but do you think that's eventually the way you'll end up?
ConanO'Brien.com
or?
I think it's irrelevant. I think it doesn't matter at a certain point. I was really glad. I mean, I think a lot of people thought during the Jay Leno thing that I was going to go to Fox. That was the big, and I remember it intentionally thinking, no, I'm not doing that again. Mm-hmm. What I loved about coming here was this is the closest thing to a hybrid, meaning I can have the show and have the platform, but also build a digital and in a way and we have complete control over it and autonomy. And that has been the big revelation of this show is being able to do both. I think the linear versus digital thing has got to go away, and you've got to realize that it's all one piece. And at a certain point, I don't care how people experience me. I have fans in Taiwan. I'm not on the air in Taiwan. I have fans in Korea that dub the show fan clubs, and they trade the videos that I do, the travel videos or the videos I do with Jordan Schlansky, our producer, Ryan Sultan in restaurants, and we have misadventures together. They translate those for each other. It's getting to the point where it's irrelevant to me.
It doesn't even matter.
It doesn't matter to me.
Yeah.
I just want people to see the stuff.
Last couple of questions, and then we'll let you get to your show. Do you turn off? Are you at home in bed at night? Do you sit and read a book, or do you?
Are you
telling jokes to your wife, shut up?
Well, the answer is both. I do read books, but I'm always,
every time I've met you, and it's only been a couple of times, but you're constantly hilarious, and there's always
I am one of those people that this is what you get. There's two types of comedians. There's the, I want to say maybe the Woody Allen type, where when they're on, but when they're not, they're almost, if you see them from afar, they look almost morbid.
Yep.
And there's a lot of comedians like that. And then there are comedians who that's just who they are. And I'm in the second group, meaning I could be on a bus, headed, to some small town, riding with a bunch of other people with my cardboard suitcase, and I'd be working the people on the bus. I don't think in an annoying way, but I'd be trying to find the commonality there. I'd be trying to joke around and make people laugh, and I enjoy it. I like it.
So if you were to go back 20 years, mm-hmm. You had built some rapid time machine, mm-hmm. and you had an opportunity to sit down with Conan O'Brien 20 years ago and give him some advice, what would you say?
I love that if I had a time machine.
That's all you would do is talk to yourself.
I know. I love that the assumption, and I think it's correct, is that I'd be such a narcissist that I wouldn't go back and try and save lives and end calamities.
Or ruin Donald Trump's career.
Right. I wouldn't do anything like that might save humanity. I would go back and have a sit down with myself.
Well, it's the only way the time machine works. That's one of the caveats.
I would tell myself the big lesson I've learned in my career. You really have nothing to lose. I shouldn't say you have nothing to lose. You have much less to lose than you think. And I was always so careful and mindful of not making a mistake and so intense and worried about a misstep. And the perspective I've had since is that things go your way, things don't go your way, the sun shines, it rains, it has sometimes very little to do with you, and that's if you're working really hard all the time. So I would say, you know, take chances, take more chances. I mean, I did take a lot of chances, but I would say, if anything, take more. I think that's something that people need to, I try to counsel young people, is especially early on in your career, take some big swings, because you can, especially when you're young, in your 20s and early 30s, you can recover from those. And you can, it's a cliche, you can learn from them. But it's true. It really is true. It's, might as well do it now.
All right, so we can take the time machine and go and end Donald Trump's career. Should we do it?
No, you can't meddle with history. His election was, you know, willed by God, and it's the destiny of the American people. You know, no, I'm not a believer in changing anything in history. You can't. He's what we've got now, and my God, he's. I don't even have to write monologues anymore.
I'm sure they write themselves.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat.
Yeah,
with
this was really fun.
Appreciate
yeah,
it. Thank
yeah,
you.
No problem.
Thanks to my guests, Conan O'Brien. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a review while you're there, preferably a good one. Thanks to the folks at Digital Media for their production work, to my editors at Vanity Fair, and of course, thanks to our sponsor today, SeatGeek. Please support them the way you support this podcast. And I will see you next week with another amazing guest.
The 2024 election means this year is going to be chock full of drama and nail-biting suspense. You deserve a politics and news podcast with expert analysis. No spin, no BS, just trusted journalists talking about what you need to know. I'm David Plotz, and each week on Slate's Political Gabfest, I sit down with the New York Times' Emily Bazelon and CBS News' John Dickerson to do just that. Join us as we unpack the latest in politics, news, and the courts. Listen to the Political Gabfest every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.